everyone, and welcome to another week of Upzoned, a Strong Towns podcast where every week we take just one big story from the news somewhere in the country that touches the Strong Towns conversation in some way, and we upzone it. I'm Kia, the regular voice you hear on this podcast every week, and I'm actually here with a special guest. I'm really excited to have Spencer Gardner here. He is a longtime Strong Towns writer, contributor. He's a longtime member, and he brought an article to our attention about his home state of Washington. Spencer, how are you doing today?
I'm doing great. How are you?
I'm doing fantastic. I'm getting caffeinated over here, which I'm embarrassed to say at 1 o'clock in the afternoon. My time is a little necessary, but I have a lot of energy to talk about the topic you brought to our attention. So for people who haven't read Spencer's work before, Spencer is a planner. Specifically, he is a transportation planner working directly with bikes and pedestrian infrastructure. But he also has a project on the side dealing with housing, and he has brought to our attention an article about some new proposed legislation in his home state of Washington that I thought would be great to bring him on to talk about, and then we can talk a little bit about how it might impact our readers and listeners in other states. It is from the Sightline Institute. It's "Can Washington Pass the Country's Most Ambitious Statewide ADU Reform?" And for those of you who don't know what ADUs are, it stands for accessory dwelling units. Think about your basement apartments, your apartments built above garages, that little tiny house in the backyard. And Spencer, I would kind of like to just kick it to you. You said that you had some sort of reservations about this, even though, like many Strong Towns fans, you're a fan of the ADU, generally speaking. Tell me why you feel a little conflicted about this one.
Well, I think conflicted is the right term. I see a lot of benefit to what is proposed. The concerns are related to the scale at which we're operating here. There's kind of a tension between a state mandating that communities do things and communities being able to figure things out for themselves. That's really the crux of the issue for me. So what's being proposed, I think, is great. And if my city were proposing these things, I would fully support them. And as it is, I'm not sure exactly where I stand on the bill. So not that I have to vote on it or anything, but there are reasons to support it. And I think there are reasons to pause and maybe think about what we're doing here. Statewide action can be really great for resolving a logjam. So here in the state of Washington, for example, especially around Seattle, there's a lot of concern about affordable housing. And the blame for part of that is rightfully placed on restrictive zoning. So there's a lot of single family home zoning throughout, just like anywhere else in the country. A lot of single family home zoning that does not allow for more intense levels of development, and that greatly restricts supply. And so in a place like Seattle, where you have a hot housing market, a lot of people believe, and I am one of those, a lot of people believe that is part of the affordability problem. So what the state is trying to do is step in and say, you as a city are not allowed to be so restrictive with the way that you zone your land. What gives me pause is that city or states can also engage in that kind of rationale to force cities to do things or prevent cities from doing things that can also have negative consequences. So, for example, states often have strict limits on the way that cities can raise money, the taxing authority that cities have. In many states, you're not allowed, for example, to use a land value tax, which I think a lot of Strong Towns proponents and others believe might be beneficial and help to resolve some of the problems that cities have, not just raising revenue, but in the ways that they raise revenue and aligning the incentives correctly so that we get better development patterns. That's just one example, but there are lots of ways in which states bracket the ability that cities have to manage their own affairs. Anytime a state is stepping in and telling cities what to do, I am concerned about what that's doing to the whole system.
That's a really great point, and it gets to a core tension that we talk about a lot at Strong Towns, which is that it matters how you do it, not just what you're building. Part of how you do it is the policy that makes it possible for you to do that. I think the land value tax example is a really good one. And I do want to say you'll be excited to know that we are doing a 1-week series on land value tax in about a month. I think I can say that publicly now, so get pumped. But I want to dig in a little bit into what exactly this bill that's before the House of Representatives wants to do. So Sightline gave us this handy little bulleted list I'm just going to read for us. And the gist of it is it's going to permit 2 ADUs per lot, whether there is a single family home, a duplex, a triplex, or a townhome there, which is actually not very different than what was on the books already. Apparently, Washington has had ADUs legalized statewide since 1993. But as you point out, Spencer, individual cities have the right to preempt this. And they usually do that through the imposition of other standards that make it functionally impossible to build an ADU or through zoning. So another thing this bill would do is it would eliminate off-street parking and lot size requirements. We're always really happy to hear that parking minimums are going down in a major region. It's capping impact fees at 50% of those for single-family homes. And it's setting utility connection fees and capacity charges in proportion to the ADU's burden on the utility system. It's also increasing some design flexibility. These are all policies, it seems to me as an outsider, that make it easier for cities to do lots and lots of things. This is the kind of policy that's removing restrictions rather than adding restrictions. What do you think the concern is there? Why is this not the kind of state policy that you think, like, what's the problem with this delivery mechanism of this policy being the state itself?
I don't know every community across the state. And in a lot of communities, there's really not the same problems as what you have in the Seattle region, for example. So I think part of it is that there might be a legitimate reason for some of these communities to have some of these requirements. Again, that's not necessarily an argument against the bill. I'm not coming out against the bill or anything like that. We need to recognize that when the state steps in, we lose the ability to adapt to our own local circumstances.
What's an example of a local circumstance that we might be wary of? I'm curious if you can give something that would help people visualize the possibility you're talking about.
Take the utility connection fees and the capacity charges. The Sightline Institute synopsis doesn't get into details about how that works. And I haven't read through the bill. I scanned through the bill, but I don't know how it exactly determines what the ADU's burden is on the utility system. But you could imagine that the state may come up with some kind of formula or some kind of broad language that caps those fees in a way that actually handicaps a community that has challenges providing the services to properties. If that individual community is left free to make a decision about how that happens, they can respond to their own circumstances. But when the state steps in and says, you are not allowed to charge over $500 for a utility connection fee, the city no longer has that option on the table. Again, that might be good. Some cities can abuse that power, but it also has a downside in that cities are not able to adapt to their own situation.
That's really helpful.
There was one thing that you missed in the legislation that I think is really important, and that is it also would eliminate owner occupancy requirements. So that's one big way that a lot of cities will, I don't think they set out to deliberately hinder the building of ADUs in their city, but people are sometimes concerned about who lives in these units, and they want to make sure that the person who owns and operates the ADU has an interest in ensuring that the neighborhood keeps up appearances. I'm trying to be charitable about this because I think often these concerns are code language for, keeping people that aren't like us out of our neighborhood. That's a really problematic way to approach public policy. There may be legitimate concerns that, for example, a large developer from out of town can buy up properties, throw up ADU structures in backyards throughout the neighborhood, and then rent them to anyone without any regard for the impact on the neighborhood or without caring what's going on because they're not actually there present. And so it could enable, slumlords basically to scatter housing throughout the city. I think those concerns are generally overblown. And to me, the larger problem is that we greatly restrict the freedom of people who own their property to use it in ways that are beneficial to themselves. We also reduce people's options in the future. I wrote an article several years ago for Strong Towns about how the owner occupancy requirement in Madison, Wisconsin, which is where I was living at the time, prevented us from building an ADU simply because we knew that at some point we may be thinking about moving, and we didn't want to sink a lot of our resources into building an ADU and then restrict our ability to sell the house or to recover that investment before having to move. Whereas without the owner occupancy requirement, we knew at least that we had the option to continue renting out an ADU and rent out the house that we were living in at the time. That requirement in particular, I think, is one that cities often abuse. And like I said, often it's couched in language that sounds lofty and nice, but in practice, it's used to exclude people from neighborhoods.
I think that's a great point. And it's a great example, I think, of why at Strong Towns, we're always hesitant to say, like, we're pro ADU, we're pro bike, you know, or whatever, pro or anti anything, because there literally is no future of the built environment that can't be applied to an end that makes the system weaker, right? And that example of you and I as homeowners who want to, you know, create missing middle housing in our neighborhoods have every noble intention in the world of wanting to create ADUs on our property, but it might not function there if it was performed by a large developer working completely out of scale and out of step with the next increment that the neighborhood might need. I'm curious if you could say a little bit about your own experience as a developer. I believe you're a developer. You say in your bio that you're getting started on your own housing middle development project in Spokane's West Central neighborhood. Can you tell us a little bit about that and whether ADUs are a part of the recipe you'll be following?
Sure. ADUs are not a part of my project. We're kind of in the final design stages, so I'm hopefully going to be applying for our permit here in a couple of weeks. So nothing's in the ground yet, in other words. Our project is initially, we envisioned it as a fourplex, basically, that kind of morphed into four townhouses on a small city lot here in the West Central neighborhood. Over time, as we've been developing the project, we also feel like we would like to implement this in stages. And so the first part of the project is simply going to be a duplex on the front of the property. So a standard, you know, duplex with front doors facing the street. But we have we've already done the design and kind of reserved the option for building a second duplex on the back of the lot that would be also in kind of a townhouse format, side-by-side duplex, which would give us the total of four units on the lot. Now, the reason we didn't really worry about ADUs in our particular circumstance is that we deliberately bought in a location where the zoning allows us to do four units by right. So we kind of kept our eye open for a property, and I am familiar enough with the zoning code that I was able to, we kept our eye on that as we were making a decision about where to do our project and where to purchase the property. A few blocks away, there is a lot of single family housing, and most of the neighborhood, in fact, is single family housing, and it is zoned exclusively for single family housing. So the West Central neighborhood is kind of an up-and-coming area. There's some new development that has really brought life to certain areas of the neighborhood. It's kind of a classic downtown adjacent old neighborhood that had its heyday in the, I don't know, the early part of the 20th century, and then over time kind of declined as people decamped for further and further out, so that it had a pretty bad reputation for several decades towards the end of the 20th century. And it's only really in the last decade or so, with some of this new development that's been happening, that things are starting to turn around. And people are rightly concerned about affordable housing. So ADUs are currently allowed in the city of Spokane, but they have some of the same requirements that this bill would eliminate. From an affordable housing perspective, I think it's good that this bill would come in and open up more possibilities for ADU construction. As a, so far on paper, real estate developer, and hopefully soon to be in practice, I could totally imagine myself making further investments in the neighborhood, maybe buying a single family home a couple of blocks away that is zoned exclusively for single family, and being able to add that ADU or build out a basement apartment, those are really important ways for somebody like me, a small scale developer, to make an improvement in the neighborhood that also keeps me financially stable. So a lot of benefit here in terms of empowering those small scale developers. That's one of the great things that would come out of this legislation. You talk about tension between the cities and states, but there's also tension between individual property owners and their city. And the city, as I've pointed out, sometimes uses these regulations in ways that are detrimental or that hamper the ability of individual property owners to operate in ways that make sense for them. There's tension on both sides here from the cities, and I see what one big benefit that I see coming from this, and one of the things that I support is the state stepping in and saying, "Hey, cities, you're just not allowed to make things so hard for the individual property owners. Free up some possibilities here, and in places like Seattle or elsewhere, we might be able to make a dent in the housing problem."
Those are all great points. And I have to say that as someone who also would love to develop that crumbling old carriage house on the back of my four family into a livable ADU someday, I share your desire for this sort of change in policy. And I also have the same concerns about how it would affect, say, people out in rural Missouri. I think you make some really compelling and interesting points there. And I want to thank you for bringing this tough question to our attention. And now I want to ask you some sillier questions about what you've been reading, what you've been watching, what media you've been consuming. It can be related to strong towns or not. It can be related to cities or not. But this is what we call the down zone here on Upzoned. Tell me what has been on your media hit list lately, Spencer.
I don't do as much reading as I would like. A couple of weeks ago, I picked up War and Peace to start it again. I used to live in Chicago, and commuting on the train was awesome because I could read while I commuted. I bike commute now, so I actually have to pay attention to what I'm doing. And that has greatly limited my reading time. So I read War and Peace once in Chicago when I was on the train, and I picked it up again. I haven't gotten too far into it, but I love that book. But that's not what I'm going to talk about today. It's a little non-standard form of media. This is a painting, and my wife and I just got a painting. We gifted ourselves a painting for Christmas. We are members of The Church of Jesus Christ of Latter-day Saints, which I know is a mouthful, and most people call us Mormons. There is an artist who does kind of church-related art, and his name is Brian Kershisnik. And this painting is just one of my favorites. It's called Jesus and the Angry Babies. And the image is so great. There's a picture of Jesus holding four little toddlers, and they're all kind of screaming or they look angry. The look on his face is so great because I can't really tell whether he's pleased or whether he's kind of concerned about these angry babies on his lap. I just love the way that it kind of personalizes him. And so we've bought ourselves that painting. He's done some great work. I went to school at Brigham Young University, and he had a display up at the art museum there that had just some fantastic work. So I've followed him since I was in college. And when we had an opportunity to purchase this, we jumped on it. So that's my down zone.
Well, I will be sure to post a link to that photo so you can judge the emotional state of those babies for yourself. I think it's a really great painting too. And I have to say, I didn't know you were a member of the LDS community. I spent a lot of my childhood in Kirtland, Ohio, which is a big Mormon stronghold, as they say, and lovely, lovely community. For my contribution to the down zone, I'm going to talk about something that actually Chuck recommended to me that I finally went to go see myself. I saw Mary Poppins last night, the new one, Mary Poppins Returns, and I found it to be just a complete delight. I really loved it. I think it deserves to win for costuming among anything, everything else in the Oscars that it's nominated for. Anyone who is interested in reliving their childhood and feeling insane nostalgia in a movie theater should absolutely give it a shot. And I think it's very, I'm not surprised that Chuck Marone, lover of all things Disney, adored it as much as he did. And every time I find something that both Chuck and I like, because we have wildly different tastes. I'm more on the like horror movies and like, you know, violent drama end of the spectrum. And he's on the kids movies and Star Wars end of the spectrum. And when we find the places where we intersect, I always just like to give it a shout out. So Mary Poppins Returns, starring the inimitable Emily Blunt.
And Lin-Manuel Miranda, who can do no wrong in my household.
On this earth, I will say. I'm also a big Hamilton fan, for sure.
We took the kids to see that over the break, and we loved it as well. It's a fantastic movie.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for tuning into Upzoned this week. If you would like to support the show, you can always give us a 5-star review on iTunes or the podcast platform of your choice. And if you'd like to support the Strong Towns message and more conversations like these across media, you can become a member at strongtowns.org/membership at any level you are able. It makes a huge difference. Thanks so much for listening in. We will see you next week, and keep doing what you can to build a strong town.